The Color Line. By 1910, Miami's blacks numbered 2,258, nearly 42% of the city's population. As traditional black areas swelled, residential boundary conflicts were increasingly common. In a revealing 1911 editorial, the Miami Herald gave its view of the spread of the black population from Colored Town. Quote, "An area in the northwest section has been given up to Negroes. White owners of these small properties are renting them to Negroes on a weekly basis. With this kind of growth, the adjacent properties depreciate in value. White people do not care to live close to colonies of Negro houses. On the south side around 20th Street is the same problem above mentioned. The conditions in both directions are steadily and daily getting worse and threaten to drive out large numbers of white people. The advance of the Negro population is like a plague and carries devastation with it to all surrounding property. The fact is that Miami is being badly injured and badly disfigured by the growth of these Negro sections." Unquote. A major confrontation occurred as blacks from Colored Town tried to move north into a white area known as Highland Park in the early 1900s. In response, some whites called for adding more restrictions on where blacks could live, proposing at a town meeting in November of 1911 to establish a residential color line. The line was to be drawn between Miami and what was then North Miami. A committee was appointed to take up the matter with property owners and others. According to Miami historian Paul George, the boundary problem moved several officials to ask the city council to pass an ordinance providing for an alley separating the races in the disputed area and to write a segregation law establishing a boundary line to keep the neighborhoods racially segregated. There was intense pressure on blacks to move out. The black population increased fourfold in the 10 years after 1910. By 1920, blacks constituted 32% of Miami's population, but occupied only 10% of the city's available space. The color line matter officially reached the Miami City Commission in 1916. Although Ordinance 199, the segregation or color line ordinance, was tabled by the commission at its meeting on February 3, 1916, the unofficial boundary, Morris Street in the north of the city, today Northwest 20th Street, remained the accepted point beyond which blacks were not to live. Ultimately, the color line did not restrain the northward expansion of the black population because, among other factors, white realtors continued to sell property to blacks on the forbidden side of the line. The color line did slow the process, however, and helped to keep Miami blacks crowded into a rapidly declining inner city. Early black businesses in Miami, 1896 to 1940. As early as the 1870s, black entrepreneurs established businesses in the Lemon City area, but it was the Colored Town section of Northwest Miami that was the heart of black businesses in Miami. The city's business and professional community developed soon after the railroad arrived. Blacks were denied equal business opportunities from the very birth of the city. In 1896, Lula Elizabeth James Loomis, the wife of J.N. Loomis, a pioneer on Miami Beach, wrote in the Sanford Chronicle, quote, "It seems strange to me that only white men are employed as mechanics," unquote. Actually, this was not strange at all in early Miami. Exclusion from work as mechanics was not the only limitation blacks faced. They were not allowed to operate businesses that catered to white people, although white merchants could operate freely in Colored Town. Blacks resented this and protested loudly against these restrictions. The Colored Board of Trade was established at the turn of the century by the black business community as an advocate for its interests. Given the period in which it operated, it became the most effective black organization other than the black church. Many of the early black business leaders in Miami belonged to the organization. Even in this oppressive business climate, some blacks succeeded mightily. Those who became rich did so by serving the black community in some essential way. One of the first things new residents needed was housing, and the black man most successful in meeting that need was Dana A. Dorsey, probably the city's first black millionaire. According to Kleinberg, Dorsey was born in 1868 and arrived in Miami in 1897. By other accounts, Dorsey was born in 1872, the son of former slaves, and arrived at Biscayne Bay even earlier. His early life reflected the harsh realities of blacks in the post-Civil War South. The only formal education he received was from a school set up by the Freedmen's Bureau in Quitman, Georgia, where he completed the fourth grade before leaving to work. His daughter, Dana Chapman, recalled in a 1990 interview that her father's excellent penmanship was a product of the little formal education he had received. Indeed, Dorsey educated himself in most matters, including real estate, where he made his fortune. Prior to moving to Miami, Dorsey lived in Titusville, Florida, working as a carpenter for the Flagler Organization. Since there were no roads to Biscayne Bay at the time, Dorsey reportedly built a raft and sailed there alone in 1892 or 1893. It was a well-timed move, as he arrived before the hundreds of blacks who came in with the railroad. Dorsey observed a critical need for housing in Colortown, where blacks were forced to live, many in tents, near their work sites. Dorsey the carpenter was in the right place at the right time, and he found his niche in black real estate. On land that he purchased in Colortown, he built small single-family homes. He never sold the houses, renting them to newly arriving blacks who were desperate to find housing. He used his rental income to purchase new property and build new houses as far north as Fort Lauderdale. Dorsey designed and built his home at 250 Northwest 9th Street in 1913, reportedly using scrap lumber from railroad cars for some of the interior. The home was recently restored by the Black Archives, History, and Research Foundation of South Florida, Inc. In 1918, Dorsey purchased 21 acres of land on what is now Fisher Island near Miami Beach so that blacks could enjoy the oceanfront. Although one of his plans was to build a fashionable black resort, his primary aim in buying the land was to establish a place for blacks because they were forbidden to go to public beaches. Briefly, the beach he owned became a popular spot for blacks to picnic. However, the land boom of 1925 skyrocketed property values and apparently forced Dorsey to sell. After he sold his island holdings to the Alton Beach Realty Company, owned by Carl Fisher, blacks living in Miami's sweltering summer heat had no access to the ocean for another 20 years. During the land boom of the 1920s, Dorsey amassed a fortune. His vast holdings throughout South Florida had increased in value to the point that he started to sell land and reinvest his money. He tried his hand at banking, building the Negro Savings Bank in 1916 so that blacks would have a place of their own to bank. At first, the venture was successful, but as the Great Depression of the 1930s hit the country, the bank faced financial disaster. Although Dorsey lost thousands of dollars when the bank folded, he made sure that none of his depositors lost money. Dorsey's second wife, Rebecca, helped pull the family through this period with substantial savings she had acquired in her own right. Despite the bank's failure, Dorsey's vast real estate holdings still provided him considerable income during the Depression. Dorsey always collected the rents personally, walking or driving to each of his properties in Colortown. But by the 1930s, his health was poor and he could no longer drive, so he hired a chauffeur who drove him to renters as far north as Fort Lauderdale in a limousine every Sunday afternoon after church. Dorsey also ventured into the hotel business. He built the Dorsey Hotel on Northwest 2nd Avenue, the first black-owned hotel in Miami. The hotel advertised in both white and black newspapers and was well known throughout the city, even though seldom used by whites. Over the years, Dorsey spent a large amount of money to modernize the hotel, including adding hot and cold running water. Aside from his business activities, Dorsey is best known for his contributions to education. He donated a large parcel of land for black schools. In 1937, Dorsey High School opened in Liberty City. For the first time, black children in that section of Miami went to school in their own neighborhood. Through these efforts, as well as the fortune he earned, Dorsey gained the respect and admiration of the white community. The Dorsey House was always filled with important guests. Some of the white millionaires who visited were awed by Dorsey's accomplishments, achieved under difficult circumstances. Some even went to him for financial help. According to his daughter, during the Depression, Dorsey lent money to William M. Burnine to help keep his store open. When Dorsey died in 1940, flags were lowered at half-staff all over Miami. On his deathbed, he donated the land for Dorsey Memorial Library, which was dedicated in 1941. Daniel Dorsey was only one of many successful black business leaders in early Miami. R.A. Powers was a black furniture salesman who originally came to Miami with a white dealer who helped him to start his own business. D.D. Cale rented houses, operated a restaurant, and owned a packing house on Dixie Highway. Moses Griffin ran a taxi line. Henry Wells managed the Brown and Wells dry goods and grocery store. Jasper Harrington, who came to Miami with the railroad and helped lay out the streets of Miami, was a successful carpenter. He built many homes east of Alapata. J.H. Hobart, a grocer and a restaurant owner, was also involved in real estate. The Reverend S.W. Brown was a South Carolinian who owned the popular Colored Town Bargain Store and other properties. Perhaps the best known black female business leader in early Miami was Florence Gaskins. She was born in 1863 in Jacksonville and came to Miami in 1896 as a widow. Ellen Johnson, an expert on local black history and the owner and manager of Lincoln Memorial Park, a black cemetery in Miami, explains that Florence Gaskins began her rise to prominence in the days of the Royal Palm Hotel. According to Johnson, quote, "all the visitors coming down from the north used to wear white, Palm Beach white it was called," unquote. Gaskins operated a laundry business and catered to the city's tourists. She collected the laundry from the hotels and brought it to Colored Town, where she hired two or three women in the community to do the work. Eventually, Gaskins prospered and began a real estate agency, a private school, and as her success increased, a junior Red Cross chapter. In addition to being an astute businesswoman, Florence Gaskins became a dominant figure in the social circles of early black Miami. Most black businesses were small, family-run operations. There were, however, some sizable black businesses in early Miami. The Colonel Bottling Company opened in 1920 and was owned by Osmond Jenkins and William Sampson. It produced, bottled, and distributed a very successful soda water. Among the sweet treats the plant produced were Orange Smile and Peach Whip. The company's old building still stands at 233 Northwest 9th Street near the Dorsey home. Colored Town also had a growing black professional community. Dr. W.B. Sawyer came to Miami in 1903, and in 1918 he helped to open the Christian Hospital, the first for blacks in Miami. He practiced medicine from 1908 to 1950. In addition, he built and owned the Mary Elizabeth Hotel and Alberta Heights, the first black-owned residential development in Miami. His daughter, Gwendolyn Sawyer Cherry, became the first black woman to be elected to the Florida House of Representatives. Dr. William A. Chapman, Sr. was a pioneer doctor. He was the first black appointed to the Florida Department of Health and possibly the first black doctor to travel through Florida educating the people about communicable diseases. From Tallahassee to Key West, he met in churches, schools, and homes to explain health issues. His Overtown home at 526 Northwest 13th Street was declared a historic site in 1983. It became the site of the Chapman House Ethnic Heritage Children's Folklife Education Center. The school board took over the property in 1984 as part of the new campus for the rebuilt Booker T. Washington Middle School. The Black Archives History and Research Foundation of South Florida, Inc. has restored the building. Dr. John R. Scott, Jr. was the first African-American dentist to practice in Dade County. Scott was born in Jacksonville in 1886 and attended public school there. He later attended Florida Agricultural and Mechanical College, later known as FAMU, in Tallahassee. Known as Pig Iron for his athletic ability on the football field, he was also an outstanding scholar. After graduating with honors, he entered Meharry Dental College. He had two locations and allowed black dentists to serve apprenticeships in his office. Dr. Scott was a shrewd investor in real estate and served on numerous social, civic, and church organizations. He died in 1935. Dr. Alonzo Potter Burgess Holly was the first African-American homeopath in Miami and possibly in the state of Florida. Homeopathy is a system of medical practice based on the theory that a drug that will produce certain disease symptoms in a healthy person will cure a sick person with the same symptoms. Of Haitian descent, Alonzo Holly was born in about 1864 and grew up in Massachusetts, one of eight children born to Reverend James Theodore Holly, D.D. and LL.D., and his second wife. Dr. Alonzo Holly was a scholar and the author of many articles and books on blacks, medicine, and religion. He also spoke French and English fluently. Holly attended Harrison College in Barbados, British West Indies, and Othstone College in England. In 1884, he entered the New York Homeopathic Medical College and Flowers Hospital, graduating in 1888. The following year, he was appointed by the Haitian government as consul to the Bahamas, where he remained for 12 years. Before moving to Miami in 1909 to obtain better educational advantages for his daughters, Dr. Holly practiced medicine in New York and West Palm Beach. His Miami office on Northwest 8th Street was the birthplace of many of Miami's early residents. Other black doctors who practiced in early Miami include a Dr. Rivers, who practiced medicine in the city from 1896 before moving to Tampa. Dr. J. A. Butler, who also owned the Magic City Drugstore on 2nd Avenue, Avenue G, and 5th Street. And Dr. Solomon Frazier, who arrived in 1904 and began a practice that lasted in the city for over 60 years. Kelsey Leroy Farr came to Miami from South Carolina in 1912, working as a bellman in what later became the DuPont Plaza Hotel. He saved his money and obtained an embalmer's license from the Renard Embalming School. For many years, he was the only licensed black embalmer south of St. Augustine. In 1924, Farr started the Lincoln Memorial Park Cemetery, the only minority-owned and operated cemetery in the Miami area. Blacks were buried in the old Miami Cemetery from its inception. Actually, the first cemetery, especially for blacks, was on 62nd Street in Lemon City, where a library now stands. According to Ellen Johnson, Farr wound up owning the first black cemetery after he was asked to disinter the bodies from the Lemon City Cemetery and rebury them in the back of the city cemetery. He later opened Lincoln Memorial Park. Among his other projects, Farr owned an ambulance service. He was one of the first directors of the Christian Hospital and was one of the founders of the Colored Board of Trade, the embodiment of black economic power in Miami after the turn of the century. Farr urged blacks to own their own businesses and pool their capital. Following his own advice, Farr and the Colored Board of Trade hatched plans to buy land in the area now called Hialeah to incorporate as a black city. According to Johnson, they were thwarted when whites learned of the plan and bought the land to prevent it from being sold to blacks. Victoria Ward, a matron of Eastern Star Lodge, helped to establish a burial society which helped people who did not have the means to bury their family members. Similar societies existed during this period because African Americans could not readily obtain insurance. George Luther Gary began the first black-owned taxi service and was one of the community's first real estate brokers. One of Miami's first employment agencies was established by Prince Hall Miller. Willie Franks operated a charter boat service for area residents and tourists. According to Lemon City pioneer Estelle DeRocha Zumwalt, Miami even had a black elephant trainer, whose picture with his pachyderm, Rosie, was seen all over the country promoting Miami Beach as it was being developed in the early 1900s by Carl Fisher. According to Zumwalt, quote, Rosie had a colored man as trainer. She learned to be very useful. She would pull up bushes and move logs. Mr. Fisher got a cart with big wheels, which Rosie would pull around, sometimes filled with children, who loved the excitement of this. Rosie was more photographed than the famous beach bathing beauties. A powerful influence in the lives of colored town residents was the community organizations, many of which still exist today. Among them are the Eastern Star Lodge, the Masons, the Elks, the Odd Fellows, the Love and Charity Lodge, and the Heroines of Jericho. Clubs included the Friendship Garden Civic Club, the Algonquin Club, the Collegians Club, the King of Clubs, the Lodge Civic and Social Club, Inc., and later the Greek sororities and fraternities. Richard Toomer's arrival in Miami in 1912 heralded the beginning of an integral part of Black Miami's emerging professional community. Born in 1861 in Baltimore, Maryland, Toomer attended Lincoln University, graduating in 1894. He proudly served his country during the Spanish-American War, becoming the first Black commissioned officer during this conflict. After the war, Toomer obtained a law degree from Howard University. In 1913, at the invitation of the Miami Chamber of Commerce, Toomer operated the first African-American law practice in the city of Miami and all of Southeast Florida. Segregation and discrimination prevented him from appearing in local courts, as this function was reserved for white male lawyers. Toomer nevertheless excelled as a legal writer, and his legal scholarship and analytical skills were sought by local white attorneys. Richard Toomer blazed the legal trail over which other pioneering Black lawyers would travel. He died in 1948 at the age of 87. Black businesses advertised in one of seven Black newspapers printed at different times in early Colored Town. All were operated by Black owners and catered to the population they served. They were the Miami Sun, the Miami Times, the Biscayne Messenger, the Miami Journal, the Tropical Dispatch, the Florida edition of the Pittsburgh Courier, and the Industrial Reporter. Most ads in these papers were small, usually stating the name of the owner and the function of the business. Others were larger, providing more information and even featuring a picture of the proprietor. S.W. Brown, who owned the Colored Town Bargain Store, was famous for his full-page ads promoting that his was the cheapest bargain house in the city. Eventually, Blacks were allowed to advertise in white newspapers. Of the early Black newspapers, only the Miami Times survived. Founded by Henry Ethelbert Sigmund Reeves on September 1, 1923, the paper was destined to become perhaps the city's most successful Black business. Henry Reeves was born in the Bahamas, but Miami presented him with a greater opportunity to establish financial security for his wife and five children. He started his first newspaper, the Miami Sun, in partnership with Reverend Samuel Sampson, Alonzo Kelly, and M.J. Brody. After operating for only a few months, they had to suspend the venture because World War I had caused a shortage of newsprint. In 1923, when Reeves initiated the Miami Times, he also opened a printing shop, which did well enough to tide the newspaper over during the Depression. The Miami of 1919, when the Reeves family arrived, had many racial problems. There was no Black voice. The Miami Times filled this void. Lynchings, the open activities of the Ku Klux Klan, and segregation were among the issues that Reeves confronted directly and courageously from the paper's very beginnings. He had taken a considerable risk in starting the newspaper anyway, since only about 50% of Blacks in Miami during the 1920s and 30s were literate. At the turn of the century, Black business activity flourished along 2nd and 3rd Avenues in Colored Town. Before the advent of the automobile, bicycles, horse-drawn carriages, and wagons rumbled noisily along its dusty, unpaved streets. The community watering spot for horses was the long trough on 7th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. All of Miami used to water up there, said Bill Sawyer Jr., son of one of Miami's pioneer doctors, William B. Sawyer. Photographs of Colored Town during this time show elegantly dressed people busying themselves along crowded streets. According to many people who recall living in Colored Town in the early part of the century, until the 1950s or so, Black people always dressed up before going down on the avenue, 2nd Avenue, even during the week. Colored Town was constructed primarily of wooden buildings, which often became fire traps. Indeed, fire was a constant enemy in all of early Miami. As mentioned earlier, much of the downtown business section, then constructed of wood, burned to the ground in the 1896 Christmas night fire, only months after the city was incorporated. As in Colored Town, the buildings were so close together that fire spread easily and quickly from one structure to the next. The Lyric Theater was one of the few buildings in Colored Town that was not made of wood. This magnificent structure still stands on 2nd Avenue at 8th Street. The building opened in 1917 and was built by a black man named Vita Walker. The Lyric Theater was the major center of entertainment in Colored Town during the vaudeville period of the 1920s and 1930s, showing silent movies to a full house night after night. The structure has recently been restored by the Black Archives History and Research Foundation of South Florida, Inc. Black business operations were sustained by a black working class, which was practically fully employed and was restricted to Colored Town in spending its money. The Chauffeur's Dispute, 1915 to 1917. In early Miami, blacks could not operate businesses that catered to whites. This led to racial confrontations, the most serious of these being the bloody dispute between black and white drivers between 1915 and 1917. Chauffeuring was a highly prized job in those days. The pay was generally better than farm work or common labor, and it was a clean job that carried a certain amount of status in both white and black Miami. In Miami, unlike other areas of Florida and the country, it was considered a white job. White chauffeurs in Miami's quickly developing tourist industry were determined to keep blacks from working as chauffeurs. The Miami Daily Metropolis reported on July 16, 1917, that white chauffeurs were chasing black drivers through the streets like a pack of hounds chasing a rabbit or a fox, while the police looked on. A 1915 booklet, distributed to attract tourists to Miami, advised prospective visitors to leave their black drivers at home, as most of the local garages refused service to automobiles driven by black chauffeurs. Typically, white tourists arriving with black chauffeurs were required to turn their vehicles over to white chauffeurs at the city limits. Upon leaving the city, the black chauffeurs were allowed to resume their duties. In February 1915, a black chauffeur from Palm Beach attempted to test the matter. With three white women passengers in a car, he made a bet with a white man that he could come to Miami and drive around the city. White chauffeurs had been warned and were looking for him. The driver, unnamed in news accounts of the story, dropped off his passengers at the Royal Palm Hotel and went for a ride around the city, ending at Avenue B and Waddell Street. He was chased by several cars with white chauffeurs and realized that unless he gave up, he would be treated roughly. He abandoned the car and walked to Colored Town. According to the Miami Herald, quote, he later appeared at police headquarters and asked for protection. He told Lieutenant McDay that, quote, he believed he'd take the train for Palm Beach and leave up their car here for Mr. Metcalf, his owner, to come after, unquote. The lieutenant took him to the railway station. He left convinced that Miami was different from West Palm and a Negro had no business acting as a chauffeur in Miami, unquote. 2 years later, a similar incident occurred. According to a January 1917 story in the Miami Herald, the black chauffeur employed by Mr. Camden of Virginia, who was visiting at the Royal Palm Hotel, was given police protection through the city to the hotel. Quote, Mr. Camden immediately hired a white chauffeur who would remain in that position while he's in the city. The colored driver was accompanied by a policeman and no attempt was made to interfere with him. The protection was promised by the city authorities before the car reached the city. Unquote. In 1917, several blacks attempting to circumvent the restrictions started up chauffeur services catering to white customers. In response, white chauffeurs chased black drivers through the streets of Miami while the police did nothing. In July, after a black chauffeur named Fred Andrews was assaulted by several white chauffeurs, Andrews searched out one of his assailants and stabbed him. Andrews was subsequently arrested, tried, and convicted for the offense. His attackers were never caught. Racial tensions mounted in the aftermath of the Andrews conviction. A few days after the trial, rumors of an imminent black uprising surged through the white community, countered by rumors in the black community that whites were getting ready to shoot up Colored Town. Miami came dangerously close to a major race riot when late on the night of July 15, 1917, a group of whites dynamited the Oddfellows Hall, then the largest building in Colored Town. The explosion brought out many blacks with guns and other weapons, but violence was averted when several black clergymen pleaded for calm, and police assured everyone that the dynamiters would be caught. Police initially offered a reward of $50 and increased it to $200 after blacks complained of a half-hearted investigation. the dynamiters were never caught. In the end, the black chauffeurs won a victory of sorts when it was agreed that blacks would have a monopoly on the operation of buses and automobiles for hire in black areas. The parties to the agreement were Miami Police Chief William Whitman, other white civic leaders, and the Colored Board of Trade. Early Bahamian immigration to Miami, 1896 to 1926. A significant portion of the city's black population was of Bahamian descent at the turn of the century. The large number of steamers operating between the Bahamas and Miami made travel inexpensive. Many Bahamian farm workers came to South Florida seasonally to work the crops, returning to the islands after the harvest. This continued the trend that had begun decades earlier when West Indian workers sold their services abroad as seasonal laborers or until a task was completed. By the turn of the century, Miami had established an agricultural productivity that rivaled and ultimately superseded that of the Bahamas, as Bahamian soil eventually lost productive nutrients from overcultivation. Entrepreneurs in Miami attracted and exploited Bahamian labor by extensive advertising in Bahamian newspapers. For weeks at a time, the Nassau Guardian carried advertisements on the front page for the Ward, Eater, and Dempster steamship lines, offering daily departures to and from Miami at affordable rates, about $14 in 1898. By Miami's second decade, Bahamian labor had become essential to the local economy. James B. Nemo, who arrived in Miami from the Bahamas in 1916, recalls, quote, "Bahamians would come to Miami and Key West during the farming season. It was a pleasure to go down to the docks in Miami on a Sunday evening during the season. You see 300 or 400 black Bahamians coming into Miami to work. Most would go back, but each season a few more would stay. That's how come you got so many Bahamian people here. In the early days, Key West and Miami had a majority of Bahamians among the blacks in those towns." Unquote. In addition to contributing to South Florida's agriculture, Bahamians who came to Miami applied the skills that they had mastered in construction, maritime, and fishing industries. Their experience with oolite limestone, which constitutes much of the island's surface, made them more marketable in the construction trades than native-born blacks who had come from states where this type of limestone was not found. Oolite was found in abundance in Miami, and as George Merrick noted, Bahamians knew how to use this resource to construct buildings. The United States Census for 1900 reported 966 blacks living permanently in Dade County. The proportion of Bahamian-born blacks was roughly 22% of the blacks in the county, a much bigger territory at the time. Gender distribution of the local area blacks was not very different between Bahamian and American-born blacks, males predominating in both groups by roughly a 2-to-1 margin. This reflected the kind of work early Miami offered. The predominant occupations among the two groups were different. The most often mentioned occupation for American-born blacks was that of common laborer, approximately 21%, while the majority of the Bahamian black males reported their employment as farm labor. Approximately 13% of the Bahamian males were employed in the maritime professions as sailors, deckhands, and other related positions. Of the Bahamian blacks, 80% were able to read and 79% could write, while 72% of the American-born blacks could read and 69% could write. In pursuit of economic gain, many Bahamians silently endured the segregation that prevailed in Miami, but some complained. According to Florida historian Raymond A. Mole, quote, "While the Bahamians found economic opportunity in Florida, they also encountered segregation and white racism for the first time." Unquote. Mole quotes one early 20th century Bahamian immigrant interviewed by Ira Reed for his 1913 book, The Negro Immigrant, who reported his disenchantment with conditions in Miami. Quote, "Having passed the immigration and customs examiners, I took a carriage for what the driver called Nigger Town. This was the first time I had heard that opprobrious epithet employed. I was vividly irked no little. Arriving in Colored Town, I alighted from the carriage in front of an unpainted, poorly ventilated rooming house where I paid $2 for a week's lodging. Already, I was rapidly becoming disillusioned. how unlike the land where I was born. There, colored men were dressed as gentlemen, here as niggers. There, policemen were dressed in immaculate uniforms, carrying no deadly weapon save a billy. Here, shirt-sleeved officers of the law carried pistols and smoked and chewed tobacco on duty. Colored Miami was certainly not the Miami of which I had heard. It was a filthy backyard to the Magic City. Unquote. Police brutality directed at blacks quickly emerged as a matter of concern among Bahamians in Miami. According to Mole, quote, in 1907, islanders complained to British Ambassador James Bryce about unwarranted police shootings of Bahamians in Key West and Miami. Bryce urged the Foreign Office to investigate, but candidly admitted, quote, there seems no doubt that the aggressors were white and the victims black, and in such cases, little hope can be entertained of getting justice in certain southern states. In such states as Florida, Bryce wrote, colored people are not treated with much consideration. Such cases frequently occur, unquote. During a subsequent investigation in 1908, a British council official reported that in Florida it was a common occurrence for blacks to be shot by police while allegedly evading arrest. By 1920, Mole reported almost 5,000 black islanders, nearly all from the Bahamas, made up 52% of Miami's black population and more than 16% of the city's entire population. At that time, Miami had a larger population of black immigrants than any other city in the United States, except New York. Calvin Johnson was an African-American pioneer who came to Coconut Grove from South Carolina in the early 1920s. At age 95, he recalled his impressions of the Bahamian blacks he saw settling in the Black Grove in the early 1920s. Quote, they were very nice people. They had a different culture, which sometimes I found hard to understand. For example, their eating habits were different. They ate seafood, mainly fish, crabs, conch, and grits, but didn't know much about vegetables. Many looked small and undernourished, unquote. In 1916, more than 800 workers, many of them Bahamians, were building Vizcaya for millionaire James Deering, who had purchased a large portion of the Brickell estate from Mary Brickell. At one time, Deering owned all of the land on which now stands Mercy Hospital and the Museum of Science. As the buildings and gardens neared completion in October of that year, the Miami Metropolis thus described the unfolding magnificence in detail, portraying the Bahamian work gangs in the woods near the palace. Quote, entering the grounds through the eastern gateway, one follows a winding road through the woods. Gangs of workmen are busily engaged in setting out special trees, flowers, and shrubbery along this road. And in through the woods, the weird chant of the Nassau Negro rises above the click of the shovel and hoe as the laborer sings in his high-pitched voice of the wonders of his native Bahamas. Unquote. Eventually, some whites became concerned about the unemployment problem created by the influx of so many island blacks and about some ship captains' unscrupulous manipulation of the immigration rule that all arriving passengers have at least $5 before being allowed to land. Miami's powerful border trade took up the debate. Quote, that there are too many Nassau Negroes in Miami was the opinion of several members of the Board of Trade at last night's regular meeting. One member stated that he knew for a fact that over 200 Nassau Negroes were in the city out of employment, and the continued influx would have a tendency to make it difficult to give them employment, and this would overload the city with unemployed Negroes. While it is necessary for immigrants to have at least $5 in their possession upon landing here, it was stated by a member that it was brought to his attention that captains on vessels bringing Nassau Negroes here have been advancing the colored men the $5, and then, after they put foot on American soil, had taken it back and passed it on to another in order that he might land. It was said that one $5 bill had been the means of admitting hundreds into the country. Unquote. Bahamians were a volatile element in early Miami's cultural mix. They thought themselves to be less servile than American-born blacks in Miami who came primarily from North and Central Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. Proud of their British roots, a culture considerably more tolerant of racial diversity than America, Bahamians were often perceived by whites as radical or militant. A near riot in Coconut Grove in 1920 convinced many whites that blacks from the Bahamas were especially problematic. On July 30 at 5 in the morning, a white woman was working alone in her kitchen when, according to newspaper accounts, a black man casually walked in and asked her for food. Allegedly, he grabbed the woman around the neck and dragged her into the backyard. Although there was some question as to the nature of the assault, whites were convinced that the woman was raped. Several hours later, a few blocks away, detectives with tracking dogs arrested Herbert Brooks, a 55-year-old black immigrant from the Bahamas, in his home. The white woman positively identified Brooks as her attacker. That night, as a mob of some 500 white men formed near the jail, the judge decided that Brooks should be moved 300 miles north to Jacksonville for his protection. Trailed by white vigilantes, the prisoner was taken the first 100 miles by the police. At Fort Pierce, he was placed aboard a northbound train. Brooks never made it to Jacksonville. Around noon, just north of Armond, he reportedly jumped headfirst through the window of the moving train. His death was ruled a suicide. Believing the mob had killed Brooks, about 400 of Miami's Bahamians assembled in the Black Coconut Grove area on the evening of August 3rd. The following day, the Miami Herald described what happened. Quote, 400 or more alien Negroes from the Bahamas gathered on the streets of the colored settlement yesterday morning and, becoming greatly excited, made numerous threats of what they proposed doing to avenge Brooks' death. Some people professed to believe that he'd been killed by the mob, which pursued him from Miami to Fort Pierce and beyond. Unquote. The gathering of angry blacks alarmed officials. For the first time in the city's brief history, they issued an order for the mobilization of the National Guard. Whites were not allowed into the area, nor blacks out of it. American-born blacks declined to participate in the disturbance. In fact, the local Negro American Legion unit was involved in the pursuit of the attacker, and black men from the unit were on guard during the disturbance. Matters quieted down after Brooks' body was put on a ship to be buried in the Bahamas.